what India heard on that open mic today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. First Lady Michelle Obama says Donald Trump's remarks about groping women aren't just locker room talk, and her words ring true for many women in India.
When this comes out in the public forum and we find out that it's happening in America by one of the most powerful, rich men in the world, it's just awful.
Also, a Native American man remembers reading an academic paper describing the language of his ancestors.
I peeled open that thing, I looked at it, and I thought, oh my gosh, I have no clue what he's talking about here.
So he went back to college to learn more. Plus, our correspondent goes on a unique quest.
I'm in a small village in Indonesia. I'm about to see the most magnificent breed of chicken on Earth.
That's all ahead today on The World. Thanks for being with us today. This presidential election campaign is unlike any other. I think that much we all agree on. And we want to start today with one clear sign of that. First Lady Michelle Obama's strong denunciation yesterday of GOP nominee Donald Trump, specifically of Trump's lewd comments in that video about kissing and groping women, essentially glorifying sexual assault.
This is not something that we can ignore. It's not something we can just sweep under the rug as just another disturbing footnote in a sad election season. Because this was not just a lewd conversation. This wasn't just locker room banter. This was a powerful individual speaking freely and openly about sexually predatory behavior and actually bragging about kissing and groping women, using language so obscene that many of us were worried about our children hearing it when we turn on the TV.
I was struck by Michelle Obama's forcefulness, but also by her measured sadness. The First Lady was saying what a lot of us are thinking. It also made us wonder how all of this looks from a place like India, because India has long struggled with a deeply ingrained culture of abuse toward women. In extreme cases, it's led to murder, as we saw with that awful gang rape in Delhi in 2012. Reporter Chavi Sachdev joins us from her base in Mumbai. First of all, Chavi, what's been the reaction in India to what Donald Trump said, the 2005 comments that were caught on video?
Oh, shock and horror unanimously across the board. There have been lots of people just aghast that he can get away by saying and normalizing this sort of locker room talk and then justifying it.
And then Michelle Obama's response, it would seem to be almost a rallying cry for Indian women. Are Indians, both men and women, talking about her remarks?
Absolutely. So I was amused on Twitter. One of the most retweeted comments is from a stand-up comedian who says that if only the Obamas lived in India, because in the state of Bihar, Barack Obama could simply make his wife president and nobody would mind, because that's somewhat like how politics does work here.
Well, that's kind of fascinating, too, because you were telling me not long ago that men overwhelmingly are the subscribers to Twitter in India, right?
That's right. We have like an 80-20 divide for men versus women, while in the rest of the world, it's close to 50-50. So there are women talking about it, of course. There's somebody I saw who said after that Michelle Obama speech, I want to vote against Trump from India. But of course, that's not possible.
Why are people so appalled when in India, what Donald Trump is describing, we believe has happened a lot, and we know the cases are many?
It does happen a lot, but that doesn't make it all right. And I think finally, with social media, women are finding that there is strength in numbers. There have been hashtags that people have circulated collating women's stories of their first sexual harassment, their first groping, their first public indecency when they were flashed. And people are finding that things they thought only happened to them in isolation are widespread. And there are finally people taking that into account and trying to make men accountable. And so when this comes out in the public forum and we find out that it's happened in America by one of the most powerful, rich men in the world, it's just awful.
There's been some consternation among Indian women about the slow pace of progress since the Delhi gang rape and death of the victim in 2012. Is there a sense that slow progress is due partly to men in power in Delhi who, like Donald Trump, have these views of women that they're practically playthings?
Absolutely. In fact, just yesterday, we had the social media and the internet erupt because the Supreme Court of India released a verdict in which they dismissed a rape case because they decided that the complainant did not act normally after her rape, because she waited really long to file a complaint and she didn't scream and she was submissive. So if these men all men on the bench have this idea of what constitutes assault and how a survivor or a victim should behave, I don't see justice coming anytime soon.
I got to say, what's really fascinating in what you've been telling us, Chavi, is that what's being said here on the campaign trail seems to almost be holding a mirror up to Indian society. Could this be the moment when India really sees how destructive these attitudes are and maybe change comes faster?
I hope so. I imagine it's not going to be a sudden change. I think it's like an avalanche. The snowball is picking up steam all over the world. Women are seeing a mirror held up across the world, halfway across the world. This is happening in a country we look up to as progressive and really a developed nation. So, yeah, I think women will see that there is solidarity and there is a change has to come everywhere. So I agree with that. Yeah.
Reporter Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai. Always good to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
We've been exposed to a lot of nastiness during this campaign, as well as a few choice words. Some can't be repeated on air. Some are even made up. And then there are some that are real, but perhaps need some explanation, like gaslight.
Trump spent a large portion of the evening gaslighting.
Like gaslighting thing of like
reverse gaslighting.
Donald Trump with all the gaslighting.
I've got the world's Nina Porzuki in the studio with me. She's one half of our podcast about language, The World in Words. Okay, Nina, gaslight. What exactly does it mean?
Gaslight is a mental health term used to describe abusive behavior. So when an abuser manipulates information to make the victim question his or her sanity. What's important here is that gaslighting is about doubting memory and perception. So it has to do with something factual. So when you're making something factual seem like it's not factual, and then the person begins to doubt what's real and what's not real. And this term has been used to describe Trump's behavior throughout the campaign, like Trump accusing Hillary of starting the birther movement against President Obama, even though factually we know that she did not, or even in his response to incidents like when Michelle Fields, the reporter who accused Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, of forcibly grabbing her arm when she tried to question Trump following a speech he gave back in March. Here's Trump's response to questioning by reporters.
Excuse me?
She did get bruises on her arm.
I don't know if they were bruises from that. Why? Who said they were bruises from that? How do you know those bruises weren't there before?
That's what the police
said. I don't know what the police said. How do you know those bruises weren't there before? I'm not a lawyer.
Whether that's gaslighting or not, this is the term that a lot of reporters have been using for comments like this.
Where does the term actually come from, gaslighting?
So the term comes from a 1938 mystery thriller play written by the British playwright Patrick Hamilton. It's a play called Gaslight. The play premiered in London and played there for 6 months. But actually, most folks familiar with the term think back to a 1944 film adaptation of the play, also called Gaslight. The film stars Charles Boyer and Ingrid Bergman, and they play a married couple. And throughout the film, Boyer is this abusive husband, Gregory, manipulating intentionally Bergman's character, Paula, to make her feel as if she's gone mad. And he does this by, like, stealing things and then telling her, you took these things, where have they gone? She hears all these noises, and he's like, what noises? Bergman starts to, you know, question her reality. And not to give away the ending, but Bergman's character finally does escape her torture, and she redeems herself in this epic scene where she has her husband tied up, and he's trying to manipulate her into getting a knife to cut him loose. And then she kind of, in this really amazing turn, reverse gaslights her husband, pretending to be insane so she can't help him out.
Are you suggesting that this is a knife I hold in my hand? Have you gone mad, my husband? Or is it I who am mad? Yes, of course, that's it. I am mad. I'm always losing things and hiding things, and I can never find them. I don't know where I put them. That was a knife, wasn't it? And I have lost it. I must look for it, mustn't I? If I don't find it, you'll put me in the madhouse.
So why gaslight?
In the film, Bergman's character Paula sees the gaslights dim and brighten for no reason, and that's one of the manipulations that her husband is doing to her because he's actually in the attic turning on the lights, which lessens the flow of gas to the downstairs lights and makes them dim. So he's actually manipulating her through the gaslights.
It strikes me that some people in our audience will not realize that back in the day, we didn't use the electricity for lights. Somewhere between candles and electricity, there were lights that came on with the power of gas.
That's true.
Just putting that out there.
That's true. And incidentally, a nice little sweet thing, Bergman won an Oscar for Best Actress for her performance in Gaslight.
Thank you very much for my Oscar, and I hope that in the future I'll be worthy.
worthy of it.
Yes, Ingrid, you were. The world's Nina Porizuki. Thank you very much.
No problem, Marco. Not at all.
Thailand is now one day into a full year of official mourning. That's by government decree following the announcement yesterday that King Bhumibol Adulyadet had died. Our correspondent Patrick Nguyen is in Bangkok, and because of strict Thai laws forbidding any criticism of the monarchy, there are legal restrictions on what he can say. So you have been to visit the palace where mourners are gathering. What was happening there, and what was the atmosphere like?
Well, there were many, many thousands of people gathered outside the palace, and all of them were wearing black. Now, this is Bangkok, so it's searingly hot, of course, so black clothing plus heat, you get people fainting. And for anyone who collapsed, these female palace officials in nicely pressed suits would come over and fan people off to revive them. As far as the mood goes, I would say it's somber and tearful, but not hysterical. I should emphasize that Thailand has a Buddhist culture that values letting go and accepting death. And that doesn't mean that Thai people aren't still in shock or even a bit of denial. But in this culture, you don't score any extra points for public displays of hysterical sobbing. That is not the norm.
What about the mood across Thailand as a whole? How is the death of the king affecting daily life?
Well, I'd say that life goes on, but everything is now in monochrome. Literally, 80%, 85% of people on the street in Bangkok are wearing either black or very muted colors. Actually, if you see someone wearing a bright red or green shirt on the street, your head will turn. It really stands out. And I think that's how it's going to be for a long while. Thailand is plunged into a year of mourning, and this is just day one. There's actually, you know, because everyone's wearing black, there's actually a shortage of black clothing. Long lines at shopping malls. I wore my only nice black shirt today, and I do not know what I'm going to wear tomorrow.
So if you're Thai and you're wearing red, for example, do you get a public scolding?
No, I don't think it's quite like that, but it's understood that you should be wearing black. It's the respectful thing to do. And look, it's not just people's clothes. The military government has ordered TV stations, all TV stations, to go colorless. So if you turn your TV on in Thailand right now, everything's in black and white.
Wow.
And that's even spread to the online world. The homepage of Google in Thailand is monochrome. And my Twitter timeline is filled with Thai people who've tweaked their profile pics so that their avatar is black and white as well.
Is there any part of the population in Thailand that is taking the death of the king less hard?
If so, they're certainly not making any noise. I should issue this caveat that I am in Bangkok, and this is the heart of the Thai state and the heart of the Thai monarchy. So right. The highest concentration of royalist are all around me. I have not been to any rural areas, so I don't know if they may be less inclined to participate, but I know that they are. You know, no matter what your politics are in Thailand, the king has been a part of your life. As you mentioned, he's been ruling for 70 years. So this is going to affect you no matter what. If anyone feels differently than that, they're certainly being very quiet about it.
But based on what you said about Bangkok, with a whole year of mourning, does that suggest that Bangkok is going to be kind of mourning the longest of the country?
Yes, for sure. I think so. As far as, you know, wearing black clothing, that's not martial law. No one's going to come to your house and make you wear black trousers. But people will make the decision to wear black for a longer amount of time in Bangkok. And I'm talking very generally. You'll have, you know, staunch royalists in the outer provinces that are going to wear black just as long as all the people in Bangkok.
The world's correspondent in Bangkok, Patrick Nguyen, telling us about the latest on the death of King Bhumibol Adulyadet. Thanks very much, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
By the way, Patrick will be back later in the show with another story he's been reporting out of Indonesia. Just ahead, the nimble fingers of Cuban pianist Harold Lopez Nussa. Stick around. You're with the world. Early in his presidency, Barack Obama famously vowed to shut down the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. More recently, he said that keeping it open is contrary to American values. Yet, as President Obama heads into his final months in office, the detention facility remains open, and there are few Gitmo watchers who see it shutting down before Obama leaves office. In Guantanamo, a military court continues to hold hearings in the case of the accused 9/11 mastermind and his alleged co-conspirators. My double WGBH colleague Arun Roth is there, and he joins me from Camp Justice, that is the legal complex at the U.S. base in Guantanamo. And Arun, before we begin, I just want to warn listeners that some of what we're going to talk about includes some very graphic descriptions of torture. So on your last trip to the war court at Guantanamo, we talked about the condition of one of the defendants, Mustafa al-Hassawi, and I gather there's new developments to report.
That's right. The background on this was Mustafa al-Hassawi was, in the words of his lawyer, raped, sodomized by the CIA. The CIA called that rectal feeding, which isn't really a thing in modern medicine. His lawyer, Walter Ruiz, told me that he wasn't even fully aware of what Hassawi went through for years. The way he learned about it was by reading the summary of the Senate torture report when it came out a couple of years ago. Here is Walter Ruiz, Hassawi's attorney.
In Mr. al-Hassawi's case, the torture report chronicles how he was later diagnosed with tears in his anus as well as hemorrhoids and rectal prolapse, which basically means that the anal tissue in his anal cavity comes out anytime that he defecates in the bathroom. So this man now is faced with a daily choice between regulating his diet, not eating, or defecating, and then bleeding profusely in his anal cavity.
Walter Ruiz has been complaining for a long time that his client needed medical treatment, surgery, to repair that damage. What we learned this week is that Hassawi is finally going to get that surgery tonight.
Now, according to the timeline, Hassawi suffered these injuries back in 2003. Why has it taken so long for him to get this treatment?
Yeah, it seems strange. And I asked his lawyer, Walter Ruiz, that question. He actually had no idea. He told me that he hadn't even been informed about the surgery through official channels or any kind of official way. He basically found out about it in passing. A prosecutor mentioned it to him in a conversation last weekend, and that's how he found out.
Wow. So this news comes just as the New York Times is publishing a multi-part series on the mental health legacy of torture on the victims. What about any of the other defendants there? Do they have ongoing medical problems from their torture in custody?
Oh, it's safe to say that their lawyers would say all of them do, Marco. They've actually petitioned to have an MRI machine brought to Gitmo so that the defendants can have their brains scanned. That's because some of them were subjected to the CIA interrogation technique known as walling. That's slamming an individual hard against a wall. The lawyers believe some of these guys have traumatic brain injuries, and that's something that they want to know about and also get into the court record. And as we know, and you mentioned that New York Times series this week, which documents this, torture has serious long-term effects on mental health as well. And it's not clear if these men have had any treatment to address that.
Finally, Arun, just run through what happened in the courtroom this week at Guantanamo. What do you think was most noteworthy?
One of the most interesting things that came up was we saw the defense arguing that the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, what's called specifically the Confrontation Clause, should apply to this trial, meaning that the 9/11 terrorists should get to confront their accusers or witnesses there in court. The government would like to have some testimony by video teleconference because obviously it's not easy to get down here to Guantanamo Bay. Now, if they were to actually bring witnesses into the court, that raises another issue. Does the judge in the war court down here have the power to compel witnesses the way he would in any other trial, which means that you can order somebody to testify who doesn't want to? What that would mean, and it sounds kind of strange, but it would mean that, say, like if there were somebody in the U.S. they wanted to draw down here, the judge could order the Federal Marshal Service to go and collect them and bring them to Guantanamo unwillingly to testify.
Arun Roth with our partners at WGBH speaking with us from the 9/11 War Court at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Arun, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
From one end of Cuba to the other now, from Gitmo to Havana. That's where Cuban pianist Harold Lopez Nussa calls home. He's 33, and when he was growing up, he really wanted to play baseball in the major leagues. But here's a twist on that old story. His family steered him to music, jazz specifically.
I came from a musical family. My mother was a piano teacher. My father, he's a drummer. My uncle, he's a jazz piano player in Cuba. So I grew up into the music when I was born until today.
For almost 2 years now, Cubans like Harold Lopez Nussa have watched big changes unfold in their country as the U.S. and Cuba have restored diplomatic relations. Some call it the Cuban thaw. Sanctions have eased, and for the younger generation, the future does look a lot brighter. For Lopez Nussa, not only is it easier to travel, but he's been signed to a record label here in the States.
The fact that I am Cuban musician who live in Havana, Cuba, and release an album with an American label, well, maybe 3 years ago, wasn't possible. So this is something that made me dream for not just for me, for my colleagues in Cuba, musicians, artists in general. I think that we are living a very special period for Cuban artists because we have the opportunity to come here and to get more exposure to our arts.
Lopez Nussa is in the middle of a U.S. tour. It's his second trip here since relations began to open. You know, it's the life of a musician on the road, just now with fewer restrictions from both the U.S. and Cuban governments.
The thing that I like most is to meet new people, to try to get a new audience to our music. That's something very special for us. Have the opportunity to play each night for different people and make new friends from there. That's something very, very special. The fact that I am far away from my home, from my family, from my daughters and my wife, well, that's something that I don't like. But, well, it's a balance between the two of us.
Simplicity there from pianist Harold Lopez Nussa from Cuba. His latest album is appropriately titled El Viaje, The Journey. You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, the world's most precious poultry, a chicken that's jet black inside and out.
Can I see inside of its mouth?
Wow.
Well, even its tongue and its throat, it's like black all the way inside of it. That is an immaculate looking chicken.
And you have to go all the way to Java to find it. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The war in Yemen might seem remote to most of us, but this week it got seriously closer. A U.S. Navy warship, the USS Mason, got fired at twice this week in international waters off the coast of Yemen. The missiles didn't hit the ship, and no one was hurt. Then yesterday, the Navy responded, firing cruise missiles at radar installations on Yemen's western coast, where the original missiles came from. That happens to be an area held by the Houthi rebels, and this is the first time the U.S. itself has fired on the Houthis, deepening American involvement in a war that's been going on for 19 months now. The World's Richard Hall is following events in Yemen from his base in Beirut. What are people in Yemen saying about the U.S. missile strikes, Richard?
Well, there's generally a concern about escalation at the moment. Many people are still holding out hope that this conflict can be brought to an end through negotiation. And when something like this happens and it brings in other players, other regional partners and different countries, it kind of pushes that possibility further into the distance somewhat. I mean, Yemenis are sick of this war. This has the potential to lengthen that war.
Do Yemenis see this kind of short back and forth firefight as kind of emblematic that the U.S. is now in this war, or do they see it kind of as a one-off?
I think Yemenis are under no illusion that the U.S. is deeply involved in this war, in fact. The U.S. since 2014 has provided logistical support to the Saudi-led coalition that is fighting the Houthis. They refuel planes, they provide intelligence for the bombing. They've also sold $22.2 billion worth of weapons since the war began to Saudi Arabia.
Right. I mean, there was this deadly airstrike on a funeral in Sana'a last week. It killed 140 people. The Saudis have stopped short of owning up to it, but they're really the only ones flying planes over Yemen. Are the attacks on the U.S. ship by the Houthis, if those attacks were by the Houthis, and they claim they didn't fire, were these attacks seen as retaliation?
Yeah, I mean, that's what many people are speculating, that this was a retaliation to that attack and to U.S. involvement in the war in general. The Houthis see the U.S. as being an active partner in this conflict. The attack on the funeral may have been a catalyst, but this is a message to the U.S. that we see you as an active partner in this conflict.
Right, and if it was retaliation, it would seem to be the most kind of public display recognizing that the U.S. is, along with Saudi Arabia, in this war.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time that the Houthis have fired directly on the U.S. and the first time that U.S. has become directly involved in the conflict by firing its own missiles. This is a new thing in this conflict. You're right.
So, Rich, just remind us what the cost has been for civilians in this war so far.
So the situation in Yemen at the moment because of this war is dire, to say the least. It's been a particularly brutal air campaign by Saudi Arabia and in turn with U.S. backing. The attack on the funeral was just the latest atrocity, but we've seen hospitals, healthcare facilities attacked, densely populated civilian areas coming under fire. The UN says that 10,000 lives have been lost during this conflict, which began in 2014. 4,000 of those are civilians, the majority of these deaths being caused by coalition airstrikes. And of course, these airstrikes are being carried out by jets bought from the US by Saudi Arabia and with US bombs. So people do see this as a U.S. war as well as a Saudi Arabian one.
And the shortages of pretty much everything, it's all led to a humanitarian crisis in Yemen. I mean, I'm seeing pictures of children starving to death.
That's right. Hunger is rampant across the country as a result of the war. More than half the population is food insecure. Human Rights Watch said recently that Yemen was a step away from famine, so that should give you an idea of how bad it is. There have also been cholera outbreaks as a result of the crumbling healthcare system and attacks on hospitals. So it's really just a dire situation now in Yemen on the ground, a humanitarian situation.
The World's Richard Hall speaking with us from Beirut about the growing conflict in Yemen. Rich, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's impossible to know at this point how or when this war in Yemen will end, or even how it will be remembered by those who live through it. But if other conflicts are anything to go by, it's likely the memory will be a lot less complex than the reality. In Russia, a new war movie is coming out next month. It's about one of the most famous episodes of World War II, at least for the Soviets. The World's History guy Chris Wolf has been taking a peek. And Chris, the movie is called Panfilov's 28. What's it about?
Marco, this is just an epic tale, so let's set the tone. This is a story known to pretty much everyone who grew up in the old Soviet Union, of 28 men armed only with light weapons who heroically stopped a German tank attack on the very gates of Moscow itself in the darkest days of World War II, when the Nazis seemed unstoppable. All the men died. It was a sacrifice comparable to Leonidas and his 300 Spartans. There was no surrender.
Wow, so this sounds like it's a really big deal in Russia.
Yes, not only in Russia, but also in Kazakhstan. A lot of the men in the unit were from Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. These are real heroes for many ordinary folks in the former Soviet Union. There are statues all over the place, streets named after them. There was a quote from the commander who allegedly said, "Russia is vast, but there is nowhere to retreat. It's Moscow behind us." And this became like one of the rallying cries of the war against the German invasion. The stuff of legend. All the men became heroes of the Soviet Union. So yeah, the movie is a big deal for Russians. Vladimir Putin himself went to a joint screening ahead of the release next month with Nursultan Nazarbayev, the president of Kazakhstan, and they sat there. The movie was crowdsourced after a trailer came out. Then the two governments came in and stepped up with all the big budget. So there's a lot of buzz. The only thing I can compare the iconography to is like the Marines who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. But there's just one problem.
Yeah, what is that?
It's not true.
the whole film is a fiction, or what's not true?
Well, their unit, the 316th Rifle Division, under the command of General Ivan Panfilov, did in fact stop a German tank attack on the day in question. Now, a division has about 10,000 men. But according to a Soviet military prosecutor who compiled a report with a historical commission in 1948, the details about the 28 men were entirely a work of fiction by a reporter. Vasily Korotiev of the Red Army's Red Star newspaper. He visited the unit a few weeks after the event, collected the names of 28 dead or missing soldiers, and filled in the blanks himself, the quotes, the details of who did what, and so on, and propelled them all to mythical hero status.
So why didn't this cause a big stink back in 1948?
Because Stalin needed the myth. He wanted the people to believe that surrender was wrong and that he was right and knew how to conduct a war. And you should never let facts get in the way of a good patriotic myth marker. So the whole thing had to be suppressed.
Is there any risk that Putin runs by kind of supporting the release of this film? He's actually opening up the can of worms again for kind of like public scrutiny.
It looks like the public loves it. They need their myths. To quote the culture minister talking about the movie, he said, "Even if this story was invented from start to finish, if there had been no Panfilov, if there had been nothing, this is a sacred legend that shouldn't be interfered with. People that do are filthy scum."
Wow. All right. So when's the movie out, and will we be able to see the fiction that is Panfilov's 28 here in the U.S.?
Well, it's scheduled for release in Russia on November 24th, but there are already clips on YouTube, so anyone who's that excited can check them out.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
What happens when the last native speaker of a language has died? Is that language dead or merely sleeping? And can it be woken up again? That's the subject of the latest World in Words, our podcast on languages. The World in Words' Patrick Cox is here. And Patrick, these are big questions for thousands of languages around the world that have died out or are about to, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to try to save a language that's still spoken, quite another to bring one back from the dead. But people are trying it in many parts of the world. And one of the most interesting of those rebirth stories is right here in the United States, in the middle part of the country. The language is Miamia, which used to be spoken by the Miami tribe. We asked reporter Carol Zoll to check it out. Here's an excerpt from her podcast.
The last native speaker of Miamia died in the 1960s. Before that, the language had been in bad shape for decades. The Miami people had been forcibly relocated twice in the 19th century, and they ended up scattered throughout the Midwest. By the 1980s, everyone thought the language was dead. But then Darryl Baldwin came along.
I remember very specifically stumbling across these language materials, several pages of what I believe to be was Miamia language.
The stuff Darryl found had belonged to his grandfather.
There wasn't any information of where he got it from, but it was probably my first real exposure to the language.
A lot was happening in Darryl Baldwin's life at the time. He'd been working in construction for 10 years, but now, in his late 20s, he'd gone back to school to get a college degree. His wife was expecting their first child. Despite all that, Darryl decided to devote some time to trying to find out more about his tribe's language.
My grandfather had since passed, but my father was alive, so I asked him if he knew anything about the language, and he said no, that he didn't. He said I should probably try to check in both Indiana and Oklahoma to see if there were any speakers left. And it was during one of those trips that I was introduced to a young man by the name of David Costa, who also was visiting Indiana to see if there were any speakers left of this language.
David Costa. We're going to leave Darryl here for a moment and talk about David. When he and Darryl met in the early 90s, David was a linguistics grad student at UC Berkeley.
No one knew if there were speakers anymore. No one knew how many materials there were. No one knew what the language was like. Just they knew that there were some materials and it at least used to be there and there was a Miami tribe.
David's advisor suggested he start digging around to see what he could find. Maybe there was enough material for a dissertation. So he started looking and was amazed by what he found.
There was a vast amount of written records on the language, but nothing had been published, or almost nothing.
Eventually, David would find three large dictionaries of the Miami language dating back to the 16 and 1700s, treasure troves of information about the language that had been compiled by French missionaries. After his initial burst of finding material in the archives, David wanted to know if there was anyone left who still spoke the language. He'd heard a rumor that there was someone in Oklahoma, a man named Woody Palmer. The more David tells the story, the more excited he gets.
In 1988, I spoke with a couple people who had met him and who said he spoke Miami, and apparently he was even told that there was this young linguist out in Berkeley who was working on the language.
In 1989, David went to Oklahoma to see if he could find Woody Palmer, but it was too late. Palmer had died.
To this day, no one has any idea whether he really spoke. He could have spoke, and I could have missed out on something enormous, or it could be that he knew about 10 words.
So, dead end, literally. Which brings us back to Darryl Baldwin.
I'd met Darryl at a powwow in Indiana, like, for about 5 minutes, you know.
By now, Darryl and Karen Baldwin had two small children, and not only were they trying to learn the language, they were also trying to teach it to their kids. They didn't have a dictionary. There was no Teach Yourself Miamia book. There were no sound recordings of the language. And no one knew about the archival materials that David Costa had uncovered. Darryl says their efforts were pretty basic.
It started with words. And so whether it was dishes, whether it was furniture, we would go around the house and tape up little pieces of paper that had words written on it.
But, he says, they could only go so far with that approach. And then he got David's dissertation in the mail.
I thought, wow, I'm really going to learn a lot about my language. And I peeled open that thing, I looked at it, and I thought, oh my gosh, I have no clue what he's talking about here.
The dissertation was full of academic jargon, discussions of things like vowel length and accent retraction.
I remember closing it and thinking, oh my gosh, there's no way I can make use of this. And I knew at that point that I was going to have to get some training in linguistics.
So that's what happened. Because of that dissertation, Darryl Baldwin got a master's in linguistics. He wrote his thesis on the grammar of Miami, Illinois. He didn't want to be a linguist. He just wanted to be able to learn his language. From then on, Darryl and David were in touch a lot. In 1997, the Miami tribe got a grant from the Administration for Native Americans, a federal agency that supports Native American communities. The grant was for language revitalization.
A position came open with this grant, language clerk.
This is Julie Olds, another Miami tribe member.
And I thought, you know, that sounds interesting. I'd like to do that.
Julie Olds was born in 1962, the same year that Darryl and Karen Baldwin and David Costa were born. They all joke that there's something special about that year. Julie was raised with a strong sense of connection to the tribe. Her grandmother had even known some of the language, but was forced to go to one of the government-run boarding schools for Native Americans.
She had two sisters. And when they sent them away to boarding school, they did not send them to the same place. So Aunt Mary was sent to Carlisle in Pennsylvania, Aunt Jo was sent to Riverside in California, and Grandma was sent to Haskell in Kansas. And all those miles apart. And that was with intent. That was an intent to break up that family unit, to break up the sharing of family knowledge and any use of language. And so that's what happened, you know, in our family.
So Julie didn't grow up with the language. It stopped with her grandmother. But when that language clerk position came open in 1997, she went for it.
Carol Zoll reporting there, and Patrick Hawk still with me in the studio. Bring us up to date. What has happened to the Miamia language since 1997?
Well, I don't want to give it all away. You'll have to listen to the podcast for that. But here is a hint. Darryl Baldwin, this year, he was awarded a so-called genius grant from the MacArthur Foundation.
Okay, very interesting. You can hear The World in Words at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and at pri.org/language. Patrick, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
A luxury chicken from Indonesia. What that means is just ahead on The World. This is the way the Nigerian online news site Pulse described a statement from that country's president, Muhammadu Buhari. You are not likely to read a more misogynistic, chauvinistic, deprecating comment about women this year, except maybe from a certain Donald Trump. Yeah, the uproar all started with First Lady Aisha Buhari giving an interview to the BBC recently. She complained that her husband's cabinet was full of strangers from outside the couple's political party, and she threatened not to campaign for her husband again unless he made changes.
Unfortunately, the people that are occupying the seats, I don't think they have a speciality that our supporters in APC does not have. Because most of these people, number one, nobody knows them. Number two, they don't know our manifesto. They don't know what we campaign for. They were not part of us completely. They don't have a mission. They don't have a vision. If it continues like this, I'm not going to be part of any movement again.
Muhammadu Buhari did not take his wife's criticism well. During a state visit to Germany, this is how Nigeria's president responded.
I don't know which party my wife belongs to, but she belongs to my kitchen and my living room and the other room. It's not easy to do away with your opposition. I hope my wife will remember that I was in the field for 12 years, so I claim superior knowledge over her and the rest of the opposition.
Yeah, she belongs in my kitchen and my other room. Buhari is a former military ruler in Nigeria who spent years trying to get elected president. He finally succeeded last year after pledging to defeat the militant group Boko Haram. By the way, President Buhari made those comments about his wife while standing next to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She reportedly glared at Buhari and then laughed. Finally today, when I first heard about this story from the world's Patrick Wynn, I was hooked. It's about the world's most precious chicken. Yeah, precious chicken. It's called the Ayam Chamani, and it is midnight black, triple black from its feathers to its bones. Patrick went to the Indonesian island of Java to pursue this rare bird.
I'm in a small village in Indonesia, and I never thought I would be so excited to meet a farm animal, but I'm about to see the most magnificent breed of chicken on earth. It's known as the Ayam Chamani, and just about every part of this bird is jet black, from its talons to its tongue. Its feathers and bones, its flesh and internal organs, they're all the color of licorice. I found the elusive Ayam Chamani outside Jakarta in a little backyard farm. The rare birds are secured behind an iron gate. The young farmer who raises them, Daus, has agreed to show me his favorite rooster. It's resting in a bamboo coop. He reaches in and tenderly pulls it out. Oh, here it comes. Wow, it's more stunning than I imagined. It's really black, but not dull black like a crow. It's got more of a reflective quality. Like a light shimmering on a puddle of oil. Can I see inside of its mouth? Wow. Well, even its tongue and its throat, it's like black all the way inside of it. That is an immaculate-looking chicken. This breed is native only to the island of Java, but these chickens are now shipped around the world as a luxury pet or, less often, an exotic meal. One U.S. seller calls them the Lamborghini of poultry. Around Java, an Ayam Chamani typically sells for about $80, a small fortune in these parts. But some specimens can sell for much more.
What's the most that an Ayam Chamani can sell for? I heard it can sell for $1,000,
$2,000.
The most, he says? Several grand. At those prices, it's definitely the most expensive chicken on the planet. But why? It's not all about the black feathers, Daus says. People really want the blood. They believe it's enchanted. And Ayam Chamani's blood can lift curses, he says, or heal all sorts of maladies. These powers are extra potent if the chicken's blood is also black as crude oil.
How about this guy? Does he have black blood?
Merah ini. Kalau ini merah.
It's red. Okay, so if he had black blood, how much more money would he be worth?
Lebih mahal kalau itu. Hitam itu lebih mahal.
Tapi kamu nggak ada itu?
Nggak ada. Kebetulan nggak ada.
It's much more expensive, of course, but he doesn't have one.
By the way, that's Sarah Sayekti, a translator. Daus keeps pricking the chickens to check their blood, but it's never black. In fact, he says the blood seems to be the only part of the chicken that isn't black, but he keeps hoping a magical black-blooded rooster will come along.
Sorry, is this an Islamic belief or is this from a different tradition?
Tradisi.
A local tradition, he says. Nothing to do with Islam.
At this point, the farm owner, Daus's boss, steps over to intervene. Her name is Tree. She wears a turquoise hijab. And she rolls her eyes at all this spooky blood talk. Do you believe that this black chicken has magical powers?
Agak ragu-ragu, ya, dalam agama, ya.
No, she says. Such beliefs are forbidden by our Islamic faith. There are zero magic chickens in the Quran. Also, black blood, she says, that's a myth.
Alas kakinya tuh harus pakai arang.
But she has heard that some farmers will dye the blood with charcoal or squid ink, all to charge crazy prices and rip off gullible customers. For most buyers, red blood will do just fine. They usually come here to drain the chicken's blood into a bag and then just leave the dead bird on the ground. That seems to bother Daus. He really adores these creatures. So when you have to kill one of these chickens, do you feel bad about it?
Ya, ada juga sih. Kalau misalnya
he would feel terrible. He would feel sad because he doesn't have a heart to.
Oh, you're too soft-hearted to slaughter the chicken. So who has to do it?
Mungkin kakak. Ada juga.
His older brother will do it.
But the farm owner, Tree, she's not nearly as sentimental. All these lovely chickens, bled dry by customers and left on the ground, Tree will carefully pluck out their luminous, dark feathers. Then she'll toss the chicken into a wok, fry it up, and serve it for dinner. The flesh may look otherworldly, but the flavor, she says, tastes just like regular chicken. For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Pondok Gede, Indonesia.
You have got to see the living version of this otherworldly chicken. You can at PRI.org. This luxury chicken ain't no $5 fill-up, that's for sure. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.